Well, good afternoon. I'm going to call the Property Tax Division to order. And welcome to all who braved the wind chills to come out today. And we are going to we don't have yet a quorum, so we'll wait on approval of the minutes. But I do want to call attention to, in your packet, there is a draft of the committee rules. Or the proposed committee rules that I intend to work with, and they're pretty similar to what you see in other committees. We're like kind of one of the last ones to do it since we had last Monday off. We don't have a 24-hour rule. That's kind of been a tradition within the tax committee to allow for a little more creativity. But I'm really going to encourage everyone from both sides to get your amendments done and drafted by Friday. Get them into the packets as much as you can. I mean, it's kind of a tradition that the last work of this committee, when we're putting the division report together, that's when, you know, there's differing priorities and people tend to reveal their amendments as they present them. But early in the session, with the bills that we're going to be hearing, I think it should be easy enough to have most of them presented early, drafted early, and then they get into the packets. Given that we have the weekend, we really shouldn't be asking our staff to stay late on Friday drafting for Monday. As much as we can avoid that would be great. The other thing that I put in the draft rule or proposed rules is that that we would ask all of our providers of background material to remember that we do black and white printing in the house, and that we look at a lot of charts and a lot of graphs, and if you don't do it in grayscale or so that it's understandable in grayscale, you just end up with a confused committee who isn't following along with what your testifier is saying. And so just a reminder to all of our lobbyist friends and others who come oftentimes with really wonderful analysis, that we want to understand that grayscale is still something you can make happen. You just have to test it before you come here. And with that, today we're going to continue our overview of the property tax system. It should be in the save portion of your packet, members. And so with that, I'm going to let the House Research staff get us going and remind us on which page we're on.
I believe we left off, Madam Chair and members, on slide 29.
All right, thank you. Why don't you begin? I think we're all just finding our papers. It's slide 29. This is the handout. We have a lot of them in our packet. And this is also on the website for anyone who might be following from home. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jared Swanson, and I'm with House Research. We're going to pick up where we left off in our property tax overview from 2 weeks ago. And we left off with Ms. Dalton taking a look at local government aid, and we're going to continue with our look at major property tax relief programs by switching over to county program aid. So county program aid, or CPA as it is often referred to, is just the county equivalent of LGA. It's a general purpose aid, so the counties can use this aid to spend this aid on anything they'd like. But it's generally thought of as a tool that the legislature can use to reduce county property tax levies. The LGA that Ms. Dalton went over 2 weeks ago had an annual total of about $534 million. CPA is smaller, with the 2019 amount right around $234 million. And the current formula is locked in at that amount. So like LGA, CPA is distributed through a formula that has two parts to it. So there's a need-based part to the formula and a tax-based equalization aid portion of the formula. The need aid portion takes into account things that are thought to influence how much spending the counties will need. And those are things like the county age index, which is just the population of the county with higher weight given to older individuals. The formula takes into account Part 1 crimes and also the number of households receiving food stamps. The tax-based equalization aid portion of the formula is just a function of the tax base, which is the market value within the county and the county population. So another way that the state provides aid for property taxes is through credits, and we're going to take a look at a couple of credits on the next two slides. One of those is the agricultural market value credit, and this is kind of the last holdout from a number of major property tax credit programs that we used to have in place in the state. And this is distributed to agricultural homesteads on a simple formula that just takes into account the market value of the homestead. The credit maxes out at $490 for farms valued at $260,000 or more. And the second credit we're going to look at is a relatively new one. It was passed in 2017, and it's known as the School Building Bond Agricultural Credit. And this not only applies to ag homesteads, but to ag non-homestead and managed forest land as well. This credit covers 40% of the portion of the property's property tax bill that goes towards school building bonds. So if the property is located within a school district that is levying a property tax to pay for school building bonds, this credit covers 40% of that cost. The first year program cost for this credit was about $36 million last year. So there are a number of other aids and credits that ultimately influence how much property tax individual properties will pay. We're not going to go through all of them in this presentation. We've covered kind of the main ones, but there are a number of others listed on this slide that even though we're not going to cover them, it's good to know that they're there. Next, I'm going to pass it over to Mr. Williams, and he's going to take a look at property tax refunds.
Welcome, Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Sean Williams from House Research. I'm going to talk briefly about sort of the state's three property tax refund programs. They're sometimes called property tax refund or PTR colloquially, but the two largest of the programs are called the Homestead Credit Refund, which is a program for homeowners, and the Renter's Property Tax Refund, which is not surprisingly a program for renters. I'd also point you in the direction of, if you look at the overview document that's sort of the text-based document in your packets, there's some more detailed information on both of these programs beginning on page 32 of the text. Sometimes there's sort of a formula that's used to calculate how much of a refund you're allowed under these programs, and for both the renter and homeowners programs, there's pretty detailed sort of example calculations for people with different tax burdens and incomes. The Homestead Credit Refund and Renter Property Tax Refund Program are a little bit different than some of the other property tax relief programs that Mr. Swanson and Ms. Dalton mentioned in that they are administered directly by the Department of Revenue. So in order to claim these refunds, taxpayers sort of interact directly with the Department of Revenue. And so there's no pass-through the counties like there are with other credits. The way these programs are structured, they're aimed at people whose property taxes are high relative to their incomes. So if a homeowner's property taxes exceed a threshold percentage of their income, then they get a refund that is equal to a percentage of the tax above that threshold. People generally apply for these refunds. They're paid out in August or September of a given year. For renters, the refund is based on the prior year's income and rent, and for homeowners, they're based on the current year's property taxes and last year's income.
Mr. Williams, I know at one time we had an issue with a lot of people qualified weren't applying, and then I know there was a big effort by the Department of Revenue and others to kind of make more awareness of this. Do you know if now the majority of people who would qualify for this are applying, or is that something we should ask the Department of Revenue?
Madam Chair, members, I haven't seen any data on that recently, so that's something maybe you could ask the department about, or we could reach out to them on your behalf and follow up.
Great. And Representative Bernardi had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wasn't quite sure when you were allowing us to ask questions, but since you asked one, I thought it was perfect timing. Okay, so my question is, I have a bill this year regarding property tax and renter credit refunds for people that are manufactured homes that are co-ops. So I have a question about that. If you could just articulate how come they're not a part of this and why it needs to be fixed. I don't know if you know that, but you could always send us the answer. And then also, what about co-ops? Like, I have one in my district called Applewood, and it's a senior cooperative, and they have condominium-style housing. I've been told that they don't get that either. Do you know anything about that, that you can explain it to us?
Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi, with regard to the manufactured park, I know that there's been some legislative activity in the last couple of years related to sort of ground lease payments for manufactured park co-ops. So I think that when you're calculating the amount of property tax paid, it's based on the amount of tax that's assessed on that sort of a homeowner's property. And so if you're in a manufactured park, you're sort of leasing property from in paying a ground lease payment, I think is how those typically work. So you're not necessarily owning the property underneath your manufactured home. And so I think that there have been instances where people aren't able to get property tax refunds based on that. So I think that's probably as much as I can give you in committee. I probably could take a look at your bill and talk to you about that maybe a little bit after committee.
Right. Well, thank you very much. And these are cooperatives where the residents own their cooperative and manufactured home park. So, yes, we will talk about it because it did pass the House last year, and hopefully it will happen again this year.
Madam Chair, Representative Barney, I know that there was a provision like that included in the vetoed tax bill from last session, yes.
Great. We will look forward to hearing more and learning more about the situation with mobile homeowners and the various ownership structures that they have. Thank you. You can continue.
Madam Chair and members, on slide 35, you can see sort of the total amount of property tax refunds. These numbers are for calendar year 2017, so you can see that the homeowner's credit is about twice as big as the renter's credit. The average refund for homeowners is about $894, and for renters, it's about $653. So in combination, these two programs are about $634 million, so they're some of the larger sort of property tax aid or relief programs. Talking briefly about the homeowner property tax refund program, the limitations. So if you look at the sort of laws governing both of these programs, there's actually just a big table and statute that just describes certain income ranges, what the threshold of property taxes is at a given income range, and then what the copay percentage is for homeowners. The income amounts are indexed for inflation. So for refunds filed in 2019, the maximum household income for the homeowner's credit is about $113,000. The maximum refunds also scale down with income, and the maximum refunds are also indexed for inflation. So for 2019, the maximum refund for homeowners is about $2,770. For renters, the way the program works is there's sort of an assumption made about property taxes being reflected in a renter's rent. And so the law just kind of makes a blanket assumption that about 17% of rent paid reflects property taxes. And so a renter would receive from that person's landlord a certificate of rent paid that sort of indicates how much rent the person paid in a given year, and then what 17% of that being reflected in property taxes. And then sort of the same formula is applied as for homeowners, but with a different schedule. So there's different income phase outs. As you can see, the maximum household income to receive the renter's credit is about $61,000, and the maximum refund is about $2,150. There's a third property tax refund program. As you can see from the slide here, it's smaller than the other two. This is a property tax refund program that's sort of targeted to people whose property taxes are increasing very quickly. So it essentially provides tax relief to people whose property tax increased by 12% or greater in the year over year. I would note that the increases sort of have to be driven by market conditions. So if you make a large improvement to your home, which causes your assessment to go up, that doesn't sort of count towards the 12% increase. So this is really targeting towards people whose either their home values are increasing or their levies are increasing significantly. This program is not targeted by income. So it's available to anyone whose property taxes are increasing quickly. The maximum refund is $1,000, and you can see it was about $3.1 million in 2017. So compared to the other programs, it's relatively small. It's 36,000 returns, and about $85 is the average refund. So that concludes the property tax refund portion.
Great. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, how does the public know about these things? I mean, I think it's probably beyond me as a legislator communicating them. Are they told about them? Do they have to know enough to go to the website to learn about them? Can they learn about them on the website? How do we communicate these opportunities? Because I know someone who's in this situation.
Madam
Mr.
Chair,
Williams.
Representative Bernardi, I know the Department of Revenue does a pretty significant amount of outreach on these. I think that to some extent there's information provided to people in their property tax statements as well. So that's sort of another venue for outreach. I think that the department is working on that, but perhaps you think that they should be doing more of that, and that could be an area to sort of speak with them or introduce legislation, I guess.
Thank you. And I do think that's an area where we have seen much improvement, but it would be great to know if it's really paying off. Because when people get their property tax statement, I think most of the counties now are giving them information about how they can apply. All tenants should be getting the certificate of rent paid from their landlord this month. So they should, that should prompt them to know, oh, I want to follow up on this and see if I qualify. One of the problems that we've had is in the past when we've increased it, people who have in the past not qualified because their income was a little too high or their property taxes were too low, somehow they didn't make the cutoff, they don't always the next time around check to see if the rules have changed and now they do qualify. So I think all of us should encourage people to apply for these programs because they really do help with housing affordability. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Hagler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just going to go over one program. It's called the Senior Citizens Deferral Program. It's a little bit of a mouthful, but this is a program that's targeted directly towards senior citizens. There are a few requirements for a senior citizen, and in particular, it's directed towards seniors who have been in their homes for a long period of time. This program works as a low-interest loan, and that's set when the senior applies, and it's set at 3% of their household income for that year, with the balance of the remaining part of their property taxes paid by the state directly to the county. And then the senior then has a low interest loan from the state, and they make repayments towards the state. The seniors are also still eligible for property tax refund. However, any amount that they do get back goes towards paying off the loan directly. And seniors' enrollment terminates if they, by death, selling the property, if they kind of move out of those income qualifications, or if the property is no longer a homestead.
Ms. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So last year I carried a bill helping with this exact thing because there's a lot of confusion out there in regards to exactly who qualifies, and also there's a lot of red tape involved with property rights and property change in property status and so forth. Do you know the status of this particular program on its usage and how many people currently are using it?
Ms. Hagler.
Madam Chair and members, I don't know that off the top of my head. I believe it might be in that longer...
The overview.
I think the number of participants is listed in there, but I can get you that information if it is not.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll review it later.
Thank you. And Representative Firtas had a question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I noticed on the bullet points of the Senior Citizen Property Tax Deferral Program that it encumbers the property with a lien. I'm presuming that also carries a rate of interest while that lien exists. And the other question is, for any seniors that have a mortgage on their home, usually there's a covenant in the mortgage that prohibits their taxes from being delinquent or having a lien. So I was wondering if you had encountered any problems with that with regard to seniors. And foreclosure actions because of that lien.
Thank you, Ms. Hagley. That might be a question that actually revenue handles more than House Research. But if you have anything that you can help us understand about that, please share it, Ms. Hagler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I do not know off the top of my head, but I do know who at Revenue can help with that information, and I will reach out to them for you.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
And the in the overview, a little more discussion on this is on page 38 to get you so that you can better understand the program. And I do think this is another one of our programs that there's less understanding of the public about. And for many seniors I know who have been scared of the word lien, will not will go to a reverse mortgage, which also is a lien, but they don't use those words. The mortgage word is more comfortable to people, and sometimes they end up taking advantage of financial products at much more higher interest rates than this would be. And so it is an option for some people who just need a little extra help to make their household budget work. And Mr. Jessen, it points out to me that on page 39 of the overview, it's 336 seniors who participated in the program in 2017. But the deferrals added up to $1.26 million. So, you know, once a senior signs up, they can go be on it for 10 years or more, accumulating that, and then it will be paid when their estate is sold. So, The dollars can add up higher than you might think when you first think that there's only 336 participants using this. Great. And now we'll get to property tax burdens.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Kathy Schill from House Fiscal. Yes, I'm losing my voice, so I only have two slides, slides 39 and 40. These are demonstrating property tax burdens, and once again, we're taking a look at effective tax rates by population quintiles. So if you took the total and divided it evenly in five different groups, that's what we're looking at. This is showing, slide 39 is showing Minnesota taxpayer property tax burden for tax year 2014. First, for effective tax rates, property tax liability over income, and then its distribution. The numbers for gross property tax were derived by adding together the numbers for the residential local property taxes, non-residential local property taxes, and the state property tax. So those three items together. In a nutshell, the graph illustrates the impact of PTR on the residential property tax burden. Property tax refunds total $588 million in 2014. They're offset by 12.4% of the residential property tax burdens. And the refunds offset a much higher portion of the lowest two quintiles, so those two quintiles at the upper top of the bracket. In 2014, residential property taxes after PTR accounted for 18.5% of total state and local property tax burdens on Minnesota taxpayers. As with property taxes in general, these rates are regressive even after the PTR is applied, going from 5.4% for the lowest income filers to 2.6% for the highest income filers. And if you turn to slide 40, that shows property taxes by quintile. And I think I'm going to stop there.
And I think in respect to your straining voice, if we have questions on that, I would encourage members to email them to Ms. Schill. And I hope your voice comes back. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Pat Dalton with House Research, and I also only have two slides to talk about. They are regarding local sales tax. This is the one area that kind of this committee gets outside of the property tax system and goes into the sales tax system. Generally, there's been a prohibition against local sales and income taxes. It was enacted in 1971 when the state enacted the local government aid program. So they've always been kind of tied to each other. What this general prohibition and statute means is that anybody who has a local sales or income tax basically has had to come to the legislature and get special legislation for it. The exception is counties were granted several years ago the ability to impose a half-cent sales tax for transportation and transit local sales taxes without voter approval. These taxes are currently imposed in 41 of the counties, and I just heard that I believe two more counties will be imposing them come March 1. These counties represent over 75% of the population in the state of Minnesota. So this is a pretty ubiquitous tax. Most of the other local sales taxes, as I said, are imposed under special law. They require local voter approval. There are 31 of them imposed as of January 1, 2019. And what I would say is if you want a little bit more detail about them, there is information on pages 51 through 54 of the larger document that you have in this packet. And the other place you can look is if you actually go to the House Research website and look under local sales taxes. There's an information brief that gives you really detailed information about what it takes to get authority for local sales taxes. And then it also has links to each of the currently imposed local sales taxes that provides lots of detail in terms of when was it enacted, what can it be used for, everything like that. There is also a resource at the Department of Revenue. It's their fact sheet that actually lists not only the general local sales taxes, but also the lodging, food and beverage, and admissions taxes. And so the website is listed at the bottom of this slide.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. And I already know that there's going to be a fair number of requests for us to consider new local option sales tax for specific cities. And it's my intent to have one day that we will hear all of the local option sales tax proposals from throughout the state. And if you are aware of cities that are considering asking that, they need to get those bills drafted and in so that we can see what we're facing and can get that scheduled. But it's one that I think we'll have an interesting discussion on what is the purpose of these, what guiding principles should we use in approving these. The same will be true on the next topic that we're going to take up, which is tax increment financing, in that our basic laws give cities, and Ms. Hagler will go over that, give cities some basic authority to just set these up on their own under the requirements under statute. But we always have cities who come forward with proposals to be exempted from some of the normal requirements. And so that, again, will be an area where we have a day in which we're going to hear a lot of bills from people who want exceptions to our underlying proposals. So all those local bills, please get them in or at least alert me that they're coming so that we can start to plan and understand what's ahead of us as we work through our committee schedule. Thank you, Ms. Hagler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Alex Hagler, House Research. Tax increment financing is a very complicated topic, and so right now I'm just planning on doing a very high-level overview for those who may not be so familiar with the topic, and then towards the end there will be slides that have where you can get more information, and of course you can ask me about it later. Okay, so tax increment financing is an economic development tool that's used to induce development of an area or redevelopment if there's an area that needs a little bit of cleaning up. As Representative Loeffler said, these are controlled locally, so there is a local finding that they want to establish this district and they have to go through the requisite steps, but they don't have to come here to get approval to create a district. So yeah, they're generally locally controlled by cities. And just a few features of the program is that there are a number of different types of districts, each with their own sets of features and limitations that come with them. When there's a new development, the tax increment financing captures incremental property tax increase and uses the money to fund the development. It captures the growth in the tax base by certifying a value of the area within the district when the district itself is created, and the rates at that time are also certified. The increment is calculated by taking the original tax rate times the captured tax capacity. And if you don't understand that, that's perfectly okay. It's, it's a little bit more complicated than that. And here on the next slide is just a little bit of an overview to get you familiar with what types of districts are out there and how many there are currently right now. And this table came from the state auditor does a legislative report, I believe, every 2 years, if not every year. And they have the breakdown of the types of districts around the state and generally where they're located. So as you can see, there are a fair few out there currently running right now. So now I'm just going to talk a little bit about what kinds of bills you're going to see here in the committee and what that kind of means. And since they originally locally, when they do have a bill to come here, it means they need some sort of exception to the general TIF laws or something like that. For example, if they want to change the type of district they are or what their increment can be used for. So the first example, this I believe was one that was actually enacted maybe in 2017. And you know, the type is kind of hard to see, but what they're asking for is to give an extension of the 5-year pooling rule, which is a rule that requires development activity in a district to be finished within 5 years of the district certification. And this district, for whatever reason, needed an extension, and this rule prevents the districts from staying around longer than necessary. And then this next one, also kind of small, but it is asking for an extension of the duration of how long the district can last. And each district type has a set duration before they must decertify. Some can be around for 20 years, 25, or small as 8 years. So for whatever reason, this district needed an extension, and it was approved in 2017. So like I said, for more information, we do have a TIF primer on our House Research website, and also the Office of the State Auditor has previous TIF reports going back few years, I think, and it also has newsletters and guides and pretty much everything, because they're the agency that actually oversees the districts themselves.
Thank you, Ms. Hagler. We're going to learn a lot more about this one as we go along, and we're going to see how creative the marketplace can be as it proposes new ways to look at development finance. The key thing to me for us to think about in TIF is that while it's initiated by a city in a redevelopment or a development context, it impacts the ongoing funding for all the other taxing jurisdictions as well, the county, the school district, the, you know, any kind of special taxing districts as well. And that's part of, I think, why we're asked to step in and kind of create, weigh the rules of the game to make sure that at some point that additional tax base that's generated gets shared with all the taxing jurisdictions. But we'll get into that more when we actually have some bills in front of us. Welcome back, Mr. Swanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we are going to take one quick look at mining taxes as they relate to property taxes in the state. So kind of the big mining-related tax that falls under the jurisdiction of this committee is the production tax. So the mining industry pays a production tax in lieu of property taxes for the production of for the mining of taconite. And the So instead, I guess instead of these mines and mining operations are exempt from property taxes and will instead pay this production tax. So $94 million was collected with the production tax in 2018, and the tax rate was just over $2.70 per taxable ton. The tax base that this rate gets levied on is a three-year average of production of taconite, and that's just to smooth out some of the peaks and troughs in production that you get with the mining of taconite. And these revenues from this tax are distributed through a formula to 27 different accounts that then get used to distribute the money in a geographical region known as the taconite assistance area. And that's just all, it's an area that's defined by school district boundaries for the most part up in the Iron Range area of the state.
Yes, Representative Rumbach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On that slide, just any trend in that number, 94? I mean, where's that relation to past years and our rate? Where are we with other mining states on our taxable rate?
Mr. Swanson.
Thank you. Madam Chair and Representatives, so the total, that $94 million, I know in the last couple of years that has been higher. And I think that there was a period of time within the last 5 to 10 years that the production was lower. And so as the production falls, that three-year average starts to fall as well. But I believe that it is starting to swing back up again. So this, it's not the highest that it's been in the last couple of years, but it seems to be increasing again. And as far as how do we compare to other states, that I'm not sure about. It's something I could look into and give you a little bit more information on, but the way that the tax is designed, it's likely that it's that varies from state to state and how that production would be taxed.
Thank you.
Thank you. And fiscal disparities is the last topic, a really simple one.
Yeah, so this is our last slide in the property tax overview, and we just really wanted to get this out there and let you know that this program exists. So there are actually two areas in the state where we have fiscal disparities programs. One is in the 7-county metro area, and the other is up on the Iron Range. And I guess at its most basic level, fiscal disparities is that it's a partial sharing of the commercial and industrial tax bases within these geographical areas. But the way it actually functions and the effects of the program are quite complex. So we're not going to get into that in this presentation, but if there are bills that come up throughout the session that deal with this program and you would like more information on it, we'd be more than happy to provide a similar presentation that gives you much more background on this program. And with that, we'll stand for any questions on the property tax overview.
I don't see any questions. I want to thank House Research for preparing this and encourage members to, when you have a chance, look at the overview for more detail on the items that we went through fairly quickly, but it's really nice to have it as a reference, and you might want to consider putting that in your save file as we move ahead. We do have a quorum now, and so I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes of January 14th. They're in your packet.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Zhang moves approval of the minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The minutes are approved for January 14th, 2019. And for those of you who came in a little later, we do have in your packet the rules for the committee this year as well. And next we're going to hear, now that we've kind of looked a little bit at how property taxes impact different property owners in different ways, you're going to find in this committee there's a lot of analysis that's available to us to help us understand what the impact of our work is on those that pay these taxes. And the report that we're going to be going over today is often referred to as the Voss Report, named for a former House member who led the tax committee, I believe, for a while, or at least came up with the idea for this. And so, you know, you can aspire to come up with something really serious in analysis, and maybe your name will live on as well. There aren't many things I can think of that are named for former legislators, but this is one. Did he represent your area, Representative Bernardi, or yours?
My
I remembered it was a northern suburb, so he's from Representative Runbeck's area. Great.
Yeah, he was in
30 years ago.
Right, and he was in my area as well, as I used to represent Coon Rapids too and stuff. So, right.
Redistricting always kind of changes our mind of like, especially when you go back 30 years. So with that, welcome back, Mr. Swanson, and we look forward to your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So we are going to take a look at what is known as the Residential Homestead Property Tax Burden Report, or as it's more often known as the VOS report. You should have a full copy of the report in your folders, and you should also have a copy of these slides. If you take a look at the report, you can see that it's mostly made up of tables with data. So we're going to be looking at a few of those tables on these slides, and it may be difficult to see these numbers up on the screen, so it will be helpful to have either the report or the slides if you can see the numbers on there. As Representative Loeffler mentioned, this is a report that's produced by the Department of Revenue, so it's more specifically it's their property tax division that puts together the report. And it's a summary of homestead property values, property taxes, and income of the homeowners. The report looks at 20 different regions throughout the state. 10 of those regions are located in greater Minnesota, and the other 10 are located in the metro area. And also, like Representative Loeffler said, this is a program that came out of legislation sponsored by Representative Gordon Voss back in 2008. That's why we often refer to it as the Voss Report. And that one-time appropriation gave the Department of Revenue funding to set up a database to track this information. They then used this database to produce this report, and the first one was given in 2009. So for each homestead in the state, this database contains the estimated market value of the parcel, any state-paid property tax refunds that the owner of the parcel has received, the net property tax on that parcel, and the homeowner's income. And these four different variables are used to produce three measures, which are also included in the report. And they are the effective tax rate, which we talked a little bit about in the overview a couple of weeks ago. And the effective tax rate is just property tax given as a percentage of the market value of the property. There's also a measure for housing consumption, and this is just the ratio of market value of the home to the income of the homeowner. And finally, what is I think is one of the more powerful tools that this database can produce is the property tax burden, which is the thing that links property taxes to the homeowner's income. So this is going to be a measure that shows property tax as a percentage of homeowner income. So before we start digging into some of these tables and looking at the numbers, I just want to mention a couple of limitations and a few things that we should think about when we're looking at these tables. There are a number of things that impact the ultimate property tax that a homeowner pays, things like tax base composition. So is the home located in an area that's primarily residential? Is there a lot of commercial and industrial tax base in the area? Is the home located among a lot of agricultural land? All of these things, because of our class rate system, will change the burden on homeowners. Local spending is also a large part of how much money people actually pay in property taxes. And so are regional programs like fiscal disparities that we just talked about and the distribution of some of the aid programs that we covered in the overview. These things all kind of work together to determine a homestead's ultimate property tax, and because of the differences in these in these factors statewide, it's tough to make really apples to apples regional comparisons in property taxes, which is really what this report is trying to do. So you should just know that this is something that can be difficult to do for a lot of reasons. And one other important thing to note is that this database does not contain agricultural homesteads, and it does not contain manufactured homes either. So the 20 regions that I mentioned will be seen on the next two slides. The first one shows kind of the 10 greater Minnesota regions. They're just really geographical groupings of the state, and they follow county boundaries. Whereas the metro regions, there are 10 as well. Anoka, Washington, and Dakota counties are each their own region, but Ramsey is split into two regions, with St. Paul being its own region and the rest of Ramsey County being another. Hennepin County is actually split into four regions, the city of Minneapolis being one, and the rest of the county is split into three. And then finally, Carver and Scott counties in this report are combined into one region. So the first table that we're going to look at is table 1.7 in the report, and this is just kind of a good starting point for you to see what information is actually in this report.
And for, if members want to see a larger version of it, it's on page 5 of the more comprehensive report that you have in front of you.
So table 1.7 has the variables and the measures that I mentioned, and they're reported. The median value for each of these is reported by region in this table. So this kind of just gives you an idea of some of the detail that follows in the rest of the report. And when we are trying to make comparisons of property taxes across different regions, there are a number of ways to do that. We can look at things like net taxes or the effective tax rate. But really what I think the true value of this report is being able to look at the property tax burden. And you can see that in the final two columns in this table, so the farthest to the right, property tax burden before PTR, which is property tax refunds, and property tax burden after PTR are shown. Keep in mind, though, that on this table you're just seeing the median value within each region, and we're going to take a little bit closer look at this as we go through this presentation. But we're going to focus on really on that last column, the burden after PTR, on this on the next couple of tables we look at. Part two of the report gives a ton of detailed information on these variables and measures. It gives each of these detailed by region. So you'll see a bulk of your report is actually section two. We're not going to go through all of these, obviously, but we are going to take a close look at that last column for Greater Minnesota and the metro area. So as you can see from this table, these are pulled from a couple of different pages on Section 2, so just the Greater Minnesota total and the metro total for property tax burden after PTR. And what these tables show, they've got three columns. The first one is the burden, which is listed as a percent. The count, which just shows the total number of homesteads that fall into each of those ranges, and then what percent of the total number of homesteads in that area are represented by that count. So you can see on this slide that in Greater Minnesota, the property tax burden after property tax refunds tend to be concentrated in that 1 to 2 and 2 to 3% ranges. So this shows that most homesteads in Greater Minnesota pay about 1 to 3% of their homestead income in property taxes. If you look at the center table on this slide, it shows the same information for the metro area. So you can see that the percentages here tend to be concentrated in the 1 to 2, 2 to 3, and 3 to 4% ranges, meaning that for most homesteads in the metro area, after property tax refunds, they're paying about 1 to 4% of the homestead income in property taxes. And then another thing that you can see when comparing the tables on this slide is that the metro area tends to have higher percentages on the upper ranges of this table as well. So if you're looking at the 5 to 9-plus percent ranges, metro area tends to have higher percentages than does Greater Minnesota. So that, like I said, there's a lot more detailed information in part two of the report. So if you want to look at some of those numbers in specific regions, you can find the page for that region, and you'll be able to see tables that basically break out that same amount of information that aren't aggregated up to the Greater Minnesota or the metro area level.
Just a minute. Representative Runbeck has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this, I know this report has been done for 20, 30 years, And is it a useful thing, and how is it being used once it's produced?
Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair and members, I think one what's unique about this report and where a lot of the use comes from is the linking of the property tax data and the income data. So this is something that only the Department of Revenue has, which is why they produced this report. Because of some of the confidentiality reasons, they are the ones who link this data up. And it's a measure that, for example, in the house property tax model, we don't have income information, and we can't link how much a person makes and how much they pay in property taxes. So I think that property tax burden measure is quite useful because it's information that we can't get anywhere else. As far as how it's used, I guess that I'm not real sure about. It can be useful, as you'll see in a couple of slides, to really show the impacts of PTR, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. So I can imagine a number of uses for this, but as for how it's been used in the past, I'm not really sure.
Well, Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Rebecca.
It's one of those really nice-to-know things. You just wonder if there's the value there for all the effort put in, or if there maybe be a more efficient way of getting to the same number, Well, that's a question.
I don't know if there's a more efficient way, but I would say it is helpful to me as I look at whether or not our property tax refund programs, which we have said are to reward, help equalize the property tax burden of people where their property tax burden is higher than their income, and it allows us to see how it's working across different parts of the state. And, as you can see from the tables, there are some really big differences between, the value of the PTR to different people in terms of adjusting the percentage of their income that goes to property taxes. There's some regional differences. The regions that are created for this can sometimes mask things, because I think the economics of a regional center in greater Minnesota, whatever region they're located in, probably has a disproportionate impact on the numbers of that region. But you can see some significant differences between different parts of the state. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just something struck in my head when you were mentioning that 1-4% in Metro and only 1-3% in greater Minnesota, but the numbers don't really verify that. So from 1-4% in greater Minnesota represents 76% of the people in that part. 1-4% in Metro is 78%, which means it's fairly comparable there. And so I just want to make sure that we are, really clarifying the fact that, it's only 11% in that 3-4%, but when you add that to the other, it adds up really to about the same between them. So I just want to make sure that we're actually comparing apples to apples and making sure we aren't misconstruing the numbers here. So comment, I guess.
Yeah, and thank you, Representative Petersburg. I think when you group things like that, they tend to group blend sort of things. But if you look at like the 1% or less, there's, four times as many in greater Minnesota than Metro. And, I don't know all the reasons for that. But, it does, this is the kind of data that you can really spend, a half hour, 45 minutes at and really keep learning more and more about it. But you really have to sit down and ponder it, I think, to understand what the pieces are. But Mr. Swanson's going to help us understand how to do that. Why don't you continue?
All right, so Madam Chair and members, the next section of the report, which is part three, has tables that are similar to 1.7, that first table that we looked at. Whereas rather than having all of the variables and all the measures included on one table, this takes just one of those at a time and presents the information by region, all 20 regions together on the same table for each of those variables. So again, we're not going to cover all of these. I'm just going to go through a couple of them in order to sort of point out some of the information that is there and how you can use this information. So With this section of the report, you can see some of the factors that tend to influence things like the effective tax rate or the property tax burden. You need to be careful, though, not to draw causal inferences from this information. So some of these things certainly do influence how much someone actually pays, but to really point at one and say, you know, this is the main cause of a difference in property tax burdens, it's a little bit more complicated than that. So I would just say that use this information to sort of inform what some of these measures are saying, but be careful not to say one thing is the cause of certain differences. This first table, 3.1, just shows sort of the distribution of estimated market values across the state. And maybe one big takeaway from some of these, some of the next four, the information on the next four slides is that when we aggregate things to the greater Minnesota level and the metro area level, it's easier to make comparisons, and it's maybe more helpful in presentations like this, so we're not going over too many slides and get information overload. But there is a lot of variation within these regions, and just aggregating up to the greater Minnesota or metro area, you can lose some of that variation. The second table is 3.6, and this shows just the distributions of income. You can kind of see once you spend a little bit of time looking at this table that greater Minnesota tends to have higher concentrations toward the lower end of the ranges presented in this table, whereas metro area tends to have higher concentrations toward the higher end. But again, if you are only looking at the two bars that go across for greater Minnesota and metro, the gray bars on the screen, you do lose some of that variation. So if you look, for example, in the greater Minnesota tables, there's a lot of difference between the north central region and the central region as well. So if you're looking at these tables to make comparisons across regions, just be aware that there are a number of differences even within the greater Minnesota regions and the metro regions as well. Table 3.3 in the slides shows the distribution of the property tax refund. So this is similar to that, you know, the first slide we looked at, that 1.7 had the median value. This shows many more ranges of property tax refunds across the state. And I think the kind of big takeaway from this one is the first column that shows no refund. So it's important to note that most people or most homesteads don't receive property tax refunds. So this is for taxes payable in 2017. There were 32% of the homesteads in greater Minnesota and about 40% in the metro area received property tax refunds. And the last slide we're going to look at from Section 3 just shows the net tax ranges for each region, and again you see some of the similar trends in greater Minnesota and metro areas where the net taxes tend to skew a little bit higher and are a little bit more spread out in the metro area, so they're not as concentrated across a fewer number of ranges, but maybe one of the starkest differences you see can be found in the highest range on this table is the $4,500 or more. And greater Minnesota has a little over 18% of the homesteads in the metro area pay a net property tax of $4,500 or more. Again, a lot of variation within both of the regions. It's a lot of information to take in this format, but as you're looking at these, just keep that variation in mind. The last section we're going to look at is just the final part of the report, which is part four, and that's the property tax burden as a percent of income. And this maybe gets back to Representative Rumbach's question about maybe what some of the greatest uses for this report are. So I would say that being able to make some sort of comparisons across regions is one way to use this report. And then the other one is to take a look at the effects of PTR, and you can sort of see the effects of PTR by different income ranges. So this is this first slide shows Greater Minnesota and the statewide totals for the median burden, median property tax burden by income. So you can see that in the first column shows the homestead income, the second column shows the property tax burden before any refunds are applied, and the final column shows the property tax burden after PTR. And the effects of PTR can really be seen in the difference between the second and third columns there. You can see this maybe most clearly at the lower income ends, and this is sort of an intentional design of the property tax refund, where it fades out as income goes up. So really the largest benefit you can see toward the lower ends. In this table, the $10,000 to $30,000 income ranges, before property tax refunds, the homeowners in that range pay about 4.6% of their income in property taxes, but then after PTR, that drops down to 2.7%. So you can see there's more variation in the second column before property tax refunds, and the effects of PTR sort of equalize to a certain effect the burden of property taxes, so that everyone looks a little bit more similar in the second column. And finally, this is just that same table for the metro area instead of the instead of Greater Minnesota. A quick note on this: the income ranges between Greater Minnesota and the metro area are different, so you can't really compare the last slide with this one. You have to use the statewide total that's on that same slide there. But the same effects can be seen with PTR in the metro area as you saw in Greater Minnesota. So particularly toward the lower ends of the income ranges, you see the burden before PTR is higher, and then after PTR, those numbers drop down and tend to be more equal across the income ranges in that final column.
And that's why I tend to think of our property tax refund program as part of our contribution to affordable housing, because you can see that it makes a significant difference, particularly for the people at the lowest incomes, in terms of affordability. And you know that a lot of those in the very lowest income grouping are seniors on fixed incomes, and any increase in their budget, their household budget, is a challenge. But the PTR really does help them manage that from year to year, even when property taxes are going up.
So members, I guess what I would note with this report is that maybe the ways to use it are the property tax burden is a good measure to use to compare property taxes across regions. So for some of the reasons I outlined on that limitation slide, it's difficult to make comparisons across regions. I think you could even still argue that the property tax burden, you could find reasons why that's not a perfect measure, but it's at least a better measure than things like just comparing net taxes across different regions or comparing effective tax rates across regions. So a big way to use this report is to make comparisons of property taxes and to sort of see the effects of PTR.
Seeing no questions, thank you, Mr. Swanson. And I think his word of caution is, if you're thinking about playing with all these variables to try and better target property tax relief through the homeowners or renters credit, you might want to talk to him to make sure you're interpreting the data correctly, because like all data, it's easy to jump to some wrong conclusions. And yet this does give us some really honest, accurate information, since it's actually the homestead value and the income of every household in Minnesota. I mean, that's amazing database to be able to work off of. So thank you, Mr. Swanson. I have been informed that the minutes were not in all the packets, so we are going to reconsider those at our next meeting when we make sure that everyone has a copy of the minutes in their packet. So thank you, Representative Petersburg, for letting us know about that. I had it in mind, but it didn't get into all of them. And as we plan ahead, you know, one of the disadvantages of a Monday hearing is that we have Monday holidays. So we lost one hearing last week, and I hear rumors that we may lose our committee time on President's Day as well, and then we have the Monday after Easter. So we're going to try and efficiently use the time that we have, but we might have to go into a couple of evening hearings, particularly when we're hearing the long list of local option sales taxes and development finance proposals. And we'll try and give you as much lead time on that as we can. But we are looking at, if we can get it drafted and introduced fast enough, that next meeting we will start our first bill consideration, and that will be actually a repeat for members who have been on the committee before, and new information for our new members, and that is the non-controversial provisions that were considered last year, technical updates, you know, clarifying language, et cetera, that were part of a vetoed tax bill at the end of last year. And while this probably will not be considered by the full House separately from the overall tax package as it gets put together, I thought it would be a good thing to kind of get just out of the way. With that, we're hoping to have that ready to go, introduced, and be able to consider that next week. And we're also going to look at discussing more the homeowners and renters property tax refund in terms of hearing from people who are in support of us looking at that in a different way. We want to start getting ideas and suggestions from the audience and from the public, and so we'll be inviting some people who are involved with affordable housing concerns and things like that to talk to us about the role that that plays in the lives of people that they represent. And we, as long as we're trying as much as we can to give a week's notice ahead of time, as we bring up bills, I really will once again encourage you to get your amendments done early. That's part of the trade-off of early notice gives you lots of time to work with our bright staff to work on amendments and not expect that you can think about it on Sunday and Monday morning before the Monday hearing, think that our staff can free up the time. So please be respectful of their time. We've got new staff at all levels, and they're all bright and capable, but they may not be able to whip it off quite as fast as some of the people in the past have. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to put a plug in for the bill that I've put in regarding the property tax refund or renter credits, however it gets moved forward. But it moved forward through the system last year, and I just want to put a pitch in that maybe that it could possibly be included as a non-controversial portion. You don't have to respond now.
If it's introduced in time, we might be able to put that on the agenda as well.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. And I'm trying to meet with everyone on the committee. It's hard to match schedules in this system, but I've enjoyed the meetings that I've had so far and look forward to talking with others about your goals and expectations on this committee. I'm hoping at some point after I've gotten around the whole round that I might be able to present some consensus committee direction that I'm hearing from people in terms of the areas that they'd like us to focus on. And with that, we are done early unless anyone has any other concerns or questions. The Property Tax Division is adjourned. Thank you.